My name is Brandon Sheehan, and we are in the heart of the Mission Mountains up in the Jocko Valley. We're on the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Indian Reservation, which is on the Greater Flathead Reservation, north of Missoula, Montana, on a river, and a river does run through it. If somebody didn't know me, I would say stay clear, because it's a wild and crazy ride when I hang out around folks. What about me? Let's see. I'm outwardly an extrovert and mostly an introvert. I'm an extrovert by force at times, but I definitely, as you can see where I stay and where I live, I like to be out alone, away from the crowds, in the dirt, in the weeds, in the timber, on the fire line. I spend a fair bit of time working in a meditation world. I practice Tibetan Buddhism. I work for a Tibetan Buddhist foundation. And my background in land management and Tibetan Buddhism came together a number of years ago when I had the opportunity to officially leave the federal government and work full-time doing land management, land stewardship, and Tibetan Buddhism together. What I tell people is I haven't figured myself out yet, so I don't have a lot to say about who and what I am. I do like to have fun. I'm a happy guy. I like peace. I like people to be happy. I'm definitely a caretaker, and I think a lot inside. I grew up between California and Arizona. I was born in Santa Monica, Venice Beach area. Dad sailed boats for a living, grew up sandy toes and salty lips. We moved to Arizona. My dad passed away when I was 6, and my mom and I followed my grandparents to Arizona. So I spent the early part of my childhood there, went back to California during the summers to play on the beach, went through college in Arizona, studied forestry and fire ecology in Flagstaff at Northern Arizona University, fell in love with fire and all sorts of things related to fire. So I was a structure fire guy for a while and wanted to go to college. So I left the structure fire world, got a degree in forestry and fire ecology, and became a full-timer with the Forest Service doing fire suppression, firefighting, fuels management. And then I moved here with the Forest Service in 2005. I transferred up here from Northern Arizona. I'm a yoga teacher as well. And as part of my path in yoga as a practitioner and then as a teacher, I was really looking for a deeper contemplative practice that I wasn't able to find in yoga. Of course, it is offered, but I couldn't connect with it, or I couldn't find the piece of it that I was really searching for. So I started studying Tibetan Buddhism in Northern Arizona and fell in love with the practice, the ritual end of it, the contemplative work. It's a really hard, brutal path at times. But sticking to that means I don't get to pop off on the spiritual smorgasbord and do something else that's easier. Keeps me in line, keeps me moving, and decided that that was going to be my long-term path. So working and studying and practicing in Tibetan Buddhism and a career in the Forest Service doing fire and teaching yoga on the side led me to find my lama, my teachers up here in Montana. Tukka Sagnal Rinpoche is my root lama's name. He's a Tibetan teacher, lives part-time here in Montana at the Buddha Garden. He lives part-time in Santa Fe with his family, and the rest of the time he's traveling to Nepal and all over Asia teaching to his students overseas. And my path in it as a practitioner has just, it's given me a part of life that I never knew was missing until I tasted it. So I stayed with the Forest Service, and during my long winter breaks from the Forest Service, I'd go to the Garden of a Thousand Buddhas and study and practice, make Buddhas. I lived in Nepal at my teacher's, actually at his nunnery, for a couple winters. So I was the one guy with a bunch of 30 nuns. I lived on the roof there, and that was a blast. I had 30 incredible Tibetan sisters that taught me a lot about how to live and how to be human, how to be compassionate, how to really live a life that trends towards the cessation of suffering, or peace, I think is what we're calling it in this vernacular. I stayed working for the Forest Service and doing this back and forth world for a number of years, and then finally I was able to leave my career position in fire with the Forest Service and switch back to a seasonal position, and I moved out to the Buddha Garden here to be a statue maker and to practice. And 3 years later, I was offered a position with the Namchok Foundation. And that foundation was created under Tulkusagnag Rinpoche to perpetuate the lineage, most of which has been destroyed in the Cultural Revolution in Tibet. The texts, the teachers, the monasteries, a lot of that has gone missing, has disappeared. The lamas, the teachers, the students have left Tibet and been refugees all over the world, and we're lucky enough to have had one of them show up here in the middle of the Mission Mountains in Montana. I grew very close with that lineage and him, and was offered a position that I could finally leave the world of federal firefighting completely. So in this foundation, we're doing a lot of things to get the lineage back together, to get the text back, to get the ritual back, to get the meditation all put together and archived and then translated and put into a form that Westerners can connect with. So part of the work I was doing today is creating content for distance learning so people can learn within this lineage how to meditate, how to find peace, how to find happiness. So there was something that I never knew I was missing until I tasted it. I think like a lot of folks, I was searching. I was looking deep, trying to find deeper meaning. Trying to find deeper meaning in my life. I was trying to find a path, an internal contemplative path that would move me towards this thing we call happiness, or move me towards a place where suffering wasn't as present. I didn't know what it was. I had heard stories and talked to people who were on different paths in which they were able to find happiness. And I wanted it. I knew I wanted it, and I didn't quite know how or what the path to happiness was. And I don't know if I know that now. I know that the path is there, and I don't know if I've necessarily found it. That is a process. But I'm a hell of a lot closer now than I was 10 years ago. I grew up Jewish, and it's a beautiful, beautiful lineage that I grew up with in Judaism. And I still was looking, still didn't taste whatever it was I needed to taste, and was finding my wings away from home and found yoga, fell in love with that, love the practice, love the meditations, love to teach it, love to bring happiness to people, and I still was looking, wanting to taste something different that would satiate a little bit of a thirst that was still there, and when I, by chance, stumbled into the lineage of Tibetan Buddhism that I practice now, I got a little taste of it, and it isn't something I can put a lot of words to. It's definitely beyond words, but I taste it. It's a lot of work. It's hard. There are many times in the practice or in the day-to-day life or sitting on the cushion that I want to run from it. I want to get away from it. I want to jump out of the airplane, pull the parachute, and fly to a nice little cozy fire on top of the mountain to work with, and you can't. I have a teacher that holds my ass to the fire, as they say. That, I think, is one of the things I was really searching for. A set path with a teacher that has been through it all, that knows the trials and tribulations of the human mind, and has tools and techniques to work me through my obstacles. Even when they're hard and they suck and I want to run and they bring tears to my eyes. So whatever that taste was, I can't really define, but it has components of hard work, a strict path, a time-honored tradition in this lineage of 5,000 years, and really somebody that has been through it that can show me the direction that I need to go as I come to my obstacles. Whew. The trials and tribulations of the human mind, greed, anger, desire, the things that lead to suffering, attachment, love, loss of love, for me, largely trying to find my love and bringing happiness to somebody else's life. Trying to understand what attachment is and how that leads to suffering. I think attachment for me can be a positive thing for a little while. I'm attached to somebody, I'm attached to a sensation or a feeling. But the one thing we have in this world is change. So that attachment and whatever it is that I'm attached to, that feeling, the sensation, the person, the love, the big trail run, the addictions, all of that changes. And whatever it is that I'm attached to or positing my attachment onto will change. And then through that, I'll have a loss. When the object of my attachment, whatever that might be, changes or leaves or goes away completely, I experience suffering from that, a loss of what it is I'm positing attachment onto. So in this practice of Tibetan Buddhism, it isn't learning how to not be attached, it's learning how to relate to it, how to relate to all of those obstacles, desire, greed, money, sex, relationship. Yeah, all of those things that arise in the mind that cause, in my mind, that cause me obstacles or lead to aggravation, frustration, anger. Those things you can't do away with. It's not blocking it. In this path, you bring it all on board and you use that as grist for the mill. So I have a lama that teaches me, hey man, when you're heartbroken or when you slip up, when you mess up, don't fight that. Don't beat yourself up about it. Don't try harder to get it back. Instead of doing all that, understand where that pain is. Where am I in my heart hurting? When I've lost partners, when I've lost family members, when I've lost a dog, when I've lost fires that have blown up and burned houses or land that I was responsible for keeping from burning. That's not going to change by bitching about it, by getting angry. My relationship to that experience is what I've learned to change and bring all that on board and use that as part of the practice to keep on moving. Does that make sense? As negative emotions, feelings, things come up, as experiences come up, as obstacles can come up, I can't control them. I can control my relationship to them. I can control when I'm driving down the highway and late for work and somebody cuts me off and is going really slow because they're going to go up and take pictures at Glacier National Park. I can't control the fact that they cut me off, but I can control that I'm not going to reach out the window and express anger to them, flip them off, curse at them, tailgate them. I could do that, and that would also set my day off in a really uncomfortable way. What I can do is take a deep breath. I can extend an emotion or a feeling of compassion or empathy and say, hey, this person needed to cut me off for whatever reason. I'm not going to pretend to know, but they did. Maybe there's something important they need to do. And instead of setting a day where I'm pissed off and angry at 6 in the morning trying to get to work because somebody needed a cool picture, I can take a deep breath and offer them the best picture that they can take in front of me without my truck in their way and have a better day. And with that, also associate with people in the world in a way that hopefully brings them a sense of calm or happiness. I'm not walking into my workplace an hour after my commute, all pissed off and angry. I'm walking in and I'm smiling and I've had my frustrations and I've let them go and I meet people. Who I am in this world is different because of the way that I try to relate to experiences that could go in a negative direction. I try to bring the best of me to the world and I fail miserably at times. And it is it is a lifelong practice. There are many flavors of Buddhism, Buddhism with a capital B. Some of the lineages of Buddhism outwardly look like they're working for the betterment of oneself solely. That's the soul path and the soul direction. At some level, that's the truth. And inherently, by bettering oneself, that person interacts with the world and brings himself into the world in such a way that other people experience happiness or a more peaceful situation. Very subtle. And it definitely, even though the practices are centered on self, come out to the world in a way that it can produce happiness or peace or alleviate suffering. In some of the other schools of Buddhism, particularly what we call the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, which the Mahayana traditions, Zen Buddhism, and some families associated with that, and Vajrayana, which is primarily Tibetan Buddhism, the sole focus is what we call bodhicitta, compassionate action, altruism, where, yes, all of those practices that work on the self and do work just for the focus of bettering oneself are opened up a bit. They exist, but the focus is alleviating suffering for all sentient beings, is how they say it. One of the Buddhist teachers that exquisitely wrote was named Shantideva. And Shantideva composed a text called The Way of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is a vow, if you will, that those of us in the Mahayana and the Vajrayana traditions take. Grossly speaking, it is a vow to continue on this path through lifetimes until all sentient beings are freed from the cycle of suffering. So baseline root in Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism is we will, those of us who partake in this practice of meditation, this practice of creating the causes and conditions to alleviate suffering for all sentient beings and oneself, I will remain on this path and return again and again rather than moving into nirvana or heaven or whatever you want to call it in different traditions, but instead of pulling out of the situation because I've met my personal goal of being happy, being out of the cycle of suffering, I will return again and again and again, lifetime after lifetime, to work to alleviate suffering for all sentient beings. I'm not done till everybody's done. So the Buddha Garden, it's the Awam Garden of 1,000 Buddhas. The whole mandala, or the whole geography, that landscape there is set up to look like an eight-spoked wheel. So there's a big outer perimeter, and that has 1,000 stupas. And a stupa is a little temple-looking thing that represents the enlightened mind, if you will. It's the mind free of suffering. And then, of course, the Buddhas are the ones that are representing that in human form. So there are 1,000 stupas that are hand-carved. Those were carved overseas by a carver that is kind of friends with the Lama. And the Buddhas themselves are on the eight spokes of that wheel. So there's eight spokes with 1,000 Buddhas on it, and then there's the outer wheel, which has 1,000 stupas on it. And then there's the big central figure, which is called Yam Chenmo. She represents, you could say, the mother of all the Buddhas. And we don't think of these as deities or gods in any way. It's all representations of the mind or the capacity of the mind or different aspects of the mind or consciousness, so of all of us. So when we look at that, we can look at that as the manifestation of the wisdom, the path, and the means to achieve happiness, peace, fulfillment of craving, cessation of suffering. I got to become a resident there. I was a resident volunteer when I left the permanent job of fight and fire for the Forest Service and went to seasonal. I lived out there in a little hut, which is called the Dorje Den, And that was, it was a sheep barn. There were sheep living in there. And one of the statue makers prior to me built it into a nice little retreat hut for the resident volunteer. So I lived there and I spent a long winter there in the other sheep barn casting these Buddhas. And they're all done by hand. It's a practice, the casting of these Buddhas. Any of the work that you do there especially is considered a meditation. We do it with the intention of benefiting others. So a long winter in a little cold barn with a wood fire stove, making these Buddhas, reciting mantras, doing meditations. We consecrate each one of those Buddha statues with sacred substances, basically flowers, incense, prayers. And there's a central wood insert that goes in right after it's poured and leveled out. This insert of sacred substances is put all the way through the Buddha. And that's called the Dzogchen, the central channel. And that channel is also put into all the stupas. It also exists in that big central figure of Yumchenmo, the mother Buddha, that two-story female emanation of the Buddha. And she, in particular, has a special line of sacredness. Down below her, down below that two-story statue, is what is called a suppression chamber. And in that chamber, there are things like guns and traps and knives and instructions to make weapons, all sorts of things that create violence in the world, warfare particularly. There are representations of famine, of disease, of illness, of suffering, of sickness, but particularly of war and violence. And all of those things, as practiced over a number of years, students or people that have nothing to do with Buddhism but kind of like this idea, would bring their things there that would be consecrated and blessed into this chamber. And they're all in concrete down below that statue. They're poured into concrete. The statue representing peace or the cessation of, say, warfare. All of this is on top of these implements of warfare and destruction. So we have good over evil. We have peace and a world where there is a lack or a non-existent, a world where warfare and hatred and violence doesn't exist, sitting above the implements that create violence and destruction. So kind of a neat fact that you don't get on the two-bit tour over there. She's suppressing violence, she is suppressing negativity, she is suppressing disease and famine and warfare. So none of this stuff is particularly Buddhist, it's human. And many people come there that have no interest in Buddhism, but dig the idea of what it is that is happening there. People praying peace, people praying no violence, people working towards, whether they're Christians or Lutherans or agnostics or atheists or Buddhists or Jews or Muslims. People all come there from whatever faith they're in, and they dig what's going on there. And that's the other half of what happens in Buddhist places, is people who don't care to be Buddhist want to learn to meditate, want to learn to work with their mind, want to learn to be happy. Everybody wants that, right? Well, we get to work in a world that is surrounded by that. They say in the West, the Western people spent decades and decades through science exploring the outer world, exploring through physics and astronomy and chemistry and geology, the outer world, and the mind included. And the Tibetans spent those 3,000 years or 5,000 years, depending on how deep you go, exploring the mind, exploring the things that happen in the mind. Why do we suffer? Why are we not happy? All we all want to do is be happy. Well, how do we do that? In all the Buddhist centers that I've ever been part of and all the Buddhist people that I've talked to, the questions come up as to whether people of other denominations or other faiths or of no faith are welcome and can come. And a quick and easy answer to that is absolutely. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. In Buddhism, that is the world in which we work and practice and study. And we can take away all the cultural stuff that makes Buddhism the flavor, the color, the incense smell of what Buddhism is, and break it down to, here's a few tools that anybody can do to work towards happiness, to create the causes and conditions to move towards a happier place, a peaceful place, move towards the cessation of suffering. Inherent in that statement is the bodhisattva vow, to think about and do the work of creating happiness for other people. And in doing so, I gain happiness. I'm the happiest person I can be when I've made somebody else happy, when I've offered a smile to somebody who's received it well. They use the term the warrior quite frequently in Buddhist worlds. And the warrior is the spiritual warrior, the bodhisattva warrior, the one who continues to work with the struggles, with pain, with suffering, with internal conflict, and keeps on that path of warfare, if you will, to eventually arrive at peace. Yeah. So peace internally, for me, is an experience where no matter what the world is throwing at me, I react to it and bring to it peace instead of anger, instead of hatred, instead of desire. And that is why the practices of this Buddhist stuff that I do are so important to me, because they give me opportunities in everyday life when I see somebody that's hungry on the street or somebody that's suffering from addiction, which is all around us in my personal life. When I see my beautiful girlfriend with a tear or frustrated with some condition out in the world around her, that makes me suffer. That is a lack of peace in me. And it gets better when I don't react to it in such a way that brings more negativity. So multi-layered, like layers of the onion, you know, you peel one layer off, there's 1,000 more to go. You pull all the religion out of there and that's it. It's grace, it's compassion. So you pull all of the religion out of this stuff, you pull all the spirituality out of this stuff, and what you're left with is grace, is love, is kindness, is wanting to recognize the beauty in people. That isn't religion. That isn't a set spiritual path. It might be all of them, but it doesn't have to be any of them. So you pull the religion out of it. You strip it down to its bare, naked level. And what do you have? You've got love, man. You got love. You don't have hate. You have peace. You don't have suffering. Yeah, and that's not religion. But it also can be religion. Some parting wisdom, if somebody's going to listen to my voice, is be peace, be love. At the bottom of all of the stuff that we are as humans, if we strip all of that away, what we are left with is, in Buddhism, what we call Buddha nature. We're left with the essence of goodness, of peace, of love, compassion. So my parting thought is, I want to, and I hope everybody else in the world has a tinge of wanting to, just be love, be peace. Don't be an asshole.